Welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
You are listening to episode 14 of the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie, and I am Dr. Donnie, your host, and today we are talking with Brandon Dryman, and this episode is called Alcohol Use Disorder - Recovered. I want to talk to you a little bit about Brandon before we jump right into the show, and first of all, he is with Local 416 out of a very large city in Indiana. And he is a paramedic as well as a coordinator for the peer support program. And Brandon travels the United States talking and speaking on behavioral topics and assisting fire departments in creating peer support teams. Oddly enough, Brandon is also an attorney and a former prosecutor in Southern Indiana. What a combination there. But what I do want to share with you are four lessons that I learned in this podcast coming up, and maybe you could listen for these and maybe there can be some others for you. But the first lesson is that random screenings at work where he was suspended for alcohol actually got his attention. And then he told me that speaking with a culturally competent social worker actually started his recovery process. The third lesson of the podcast that I learned is that his recovery actually saved his family, which I am very, very happy for. Recovery and marriage counseling. And the fourth one is where he turned to self-care, and he says that self-care is just an absolute must. Let's go ahead and bring in Brandon right now.
Oh, Brandon.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll just do a little bit of a background. I actually met Brandon probably about 3 weeks ago at a health and wellness conference over here in Dayton, Ohio. He's actually in a little suburb called Beaver Creek, Ohio. And Brandon, you were one of the speakers, and I was intrigued by your story and everything like that. And obviously that was one of the reasons why I wanted to reach out to you. So it was really nice to meet you.
Good. Yeah,
at
you too.
Conference. If you would, Brandon, tell us a little bit about your work. And, you know, I also noticed that you were also a former prosecutor in Southern Indiana. So
yeah,
that's a story in and of itself, I imagine, going from prosecutor to firefighter and EMT. But I'll let you take it from there. Talk to us about the hats you wear as a professional.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I started out many years ago as a volunteer firefighter down in Southern Indiana. I actually got involved with that when I was 16. As a junior firefighter, and I also started driving ambulances at that time. The regulations, I don't know what they are now, but back then, if you had a driver's license, you could drive an ambulance. So I got started in fire and EMS very early on. Fell in love with it, really in my heart, even as a kid growing up watching Emergency, for any listeners who remember Johnny and Roy and Rampart and all that stuff. Emergency was a big influence on me. I knew I wanted to be a firefighter. Went to college, got a business degree, went to law school because I had the opportunity, and thought, you know what, why not? I don't know if I'll ever have the chance again. So I went to law school, thought maybe I would get involved in federal law enforcement on some level. That didn't work out because of some color blindness issues. So I went on and was a prosecutor and continued to be a volunteer firefighter while I was a prosecutor. And my office was actually right next door to fire department headquarters where I worked. And all day long, the engines and rescue were coming in and out. I was like, man, that's really what I want to be doing. So my brother was a firefighter, and he told me that the agency that I currently work for was hiring. So I went in, put an application in, got hired. Loved it. That was the greatest career move I ever made. I've been doing this for 19 years as a career. At this point, I'm a paramedic, had some stumbling blocks along the way. Early on as a volunteer, I was exposed to some really dramatic calls like a lot of us are. And one of the tough parts of being a volunteer firefighter in a small community is you respond on a lot of people you know. I work in an area now that I don't know a lot of the people I run on now, but back then I did. And one of my first calls, in fact, it was my first call as an EMT on the ambulance, was on my great uncle who had been shot in the head. And I was not at all emotionally mature enough to deal with that. But, you know, again, this was the early 90s. We didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So I stuffed that down and never dealt with it professionally. And throughout the years, exposed to more and more trauma, I developed alcohol use disorder. I was medicating anxiety, trying to get sleep. And I used alcohol to do that. And eventually I got called for a random alcohol and drug screen at my current job. And I didn't think I was going to have any problem. I was even laughing as I walked out of the firehouse about the whole thing, how silly it was. And then lo and behold, I ended up blowing positive that morning because I had enough alcohol left over in my system from the night before. So I was suspended. Fortunately, we have a really good employee assistance program. I was able to get with a social worker who was very culturally competent, understood how we think, how we work, was able to get sober. And that's when it kind of dawned on me that I'm not the only guy on the job with these issues by a long shot. So I wanted to figure out a way to help out. I got involved with our CISM program. And we later, within a couple of years, shifted to a peer support model. We moved away from CISM into the peer support model. Kind of worked my way up through the ranks of the team and ended up becoming coordinator of that. That's my current role. I did that while working out in the companies for several years, assigned to a ladder and then an engine. But it just got to be too much. Like, people were really starting to reach out for help. So I moved into the office full time a little over almost 4 years ago. And that's what I've been doing since. I went and got my certification from the state of Indiana as a certified addiction peer recovery coach, as well as my community health worker certified recovery specialist certifications. So I can kind of help coordinate with people what recovery looks like for them. So I work a lot with firefighters throughout the state who have addiction issues. I got my yoga teacher training. I did 200-hour training there. Took a yoga of 12-step recovery program as well so that I can hold space for people in recovery. Started meditating, all that stuff that I never thought in a million years I would be doing. But it's really, you know, recovery has opened so many doors, and my family, you know, it's recovery saved not just my job, but it saved my family.
Talk to me a little bit about your family.
I'm married. We've been married almost 19 years. We got married like halfway through my first year on the job. So it's easier for me to keep track of my anniversaries that way. However many years I've been on the job, that's my anniversary. But we have a almost 15-year-old son. He's a freshman in high school, and we have a very good relationship now, but for years I neglected that relationship. You know, my wife could tell there was something wrong, but she didn't know where to turn. We don't do a very good job of supplying spouses with resources in public safety so that they, when they see these problems arising, that they know where they can reach out and get us help without jeopardizing our jobs and things like that.
Yeah. Now, Brandon, when did you, when you talked about your alcohol use disorder and you went and got help, how many years ago was that?
That was 8 years ago. That was in St. Patrick's Day of 2012 was my last drink.
Okay. So your son then was about 7 years old or so. So
yeah.
So from being born up to that 7 year mark, alcohol was part of the family.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, as somebody with that issue, I knew when the pharmacies opened. Like, I didn't want to wait for the liquor stores to open. The pharmacies opened sooner. So I can remember coming home from work and doing the trade-off with my wife and, you know, getting my son and running to the local pharmacy so I could get my vodka for the day and then driving. Like, that was a priority, that I would load him up and go do that. And it's just amazing looking back on that. But, you know, it when they say it's a family disease, I think there's a genetic component, but there's also that whole idea that everybody in the house is going to suffer from that. And that was certainly the case in my family. My wife and my son suffered from my use, probably even more so than I did. So,
Now, Brandon, if you would, and because, you know, with work-life balance, of course, we talk about that a lot about, you know, when I teach work-life balance, I use a definition that is like this. It says, are your day-to-day behaviors in alignment with your priorities in life? And that is work-life balance for me, you know, and what I teach and my philosophy and my research. So are your day-to-day behaviors in alignment with your priorities in life? Now, when you reflect on it back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure running to the store to pick up vodka, you know, obviously it was the priority that you had in mind back then, but it probably was not necessarily the priority that you wish you had in mind.
I would agree with that.
Would you talk a little bit about that? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's absolutely right. And it's funny, you know, when I look back, if somebody said, list out the three most important things in your life, you know, and I probably would have said my wife, my son, and my job.
Yeah.
But if somebody said, well, how come alcohol isn't on that list? I would have done a double take and then had to realize that actually that was taking precedence over everything. That should have been number one on my list, whether I wanted to admit that or not. Mm-hmm. But I think that goes to your point that, you know, it was to me, my medication, and that might sound, you know, a bit like a cop-out, but that's how I viewed it was that's what kept me there for my family. That was my excuse so that I could be present for my family, even though it was doing just the opposite. You know, my priorities were just that screwed up.
Yeah. How did you turn the corner, St. Patrick's Day?
It all came down to me getting pulled for that random screen. Okay. My wife had been telling me for some time that I had an issue, but I didn't want to listen to that. She didn't know, you know, hey, firefighters drink. She just didn't understand the culture. I had a million excuses why she didn't understand what was going on. And then when it came from an independent source, like I realized, oh man, I showed up to work with alcohol in my system. That is a problem. That is like, absolutely. My wife was right that there's something there, but had I not gotten in trouble, I don't know how it would have come out. I really don't. I mean that,
yeah,
like a lot of people, it's that rock bottom we say, but for me, I mean, that was my motivation to change was it really brought it home.
Yeah. And then how much did your marriage struggle during that time?
It struggled significantly. You know, I've heard it said since then, and it's true, you know, the whole, we became roommates. You know, we were two separate people, you know, when we got married, we became one. That's truly how I viewed it. But, you know, over time she learned how to live life independently of me because you know, I was never mean. I just wasn't present. I neglected family matters. I neglected going out. I neglected time together. And we suffered a lot as a result where we basically inhabited the same house, but we were no longer partners. There wasn't any animosity. It was just, you know, we were there passing along in the hallway and didn't have anything in common.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing some very rigorous marriage counseling. It was a weekend program, but it was intense, called RetroVi, which we actually did in Columbus, Ohio. And that really turned things around for us. But
good.
Yeah, but it was bad. I mean, again, it was weird. There wasn't any real animosity, but we were just strangers, you know, two people who were once so in love just drifted apart so completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you mentioned your son. How has that been going since you stopped drinking?
It's going well. You know, I think he still remembers probably going to the pharmacies with me. But it's gone great. I've gone from, you know, completely not having really any involvement with family to now very, very involved. He's a percussionist. So he's now We've got the drum set at home. I play guitar, so we've been able to have a lot of bonding through music and then his marching band activities. He's involved with the Fire Explorers program. He's interested in this job. So that's exciting as well that he's able to engage in that. And then through music, and we're both outdoorsy types, so we like to go on walks. And this is all stuff that if I was still drinking, none of that would have been a priority. Just the ability to stop and the true joy of just being able to walk outside and share space with somebody in the outdoors. You can't put a price tag on that, but I would have at one time, you know?
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. You know, and Brandon, I know you don't know a whole lot about my work that I've been involved in and research, but one of the things that as I talk about work-life balance, as I mentioned about aligning our daily behaviors with our priorities in life, my research also shows that there appear to be two universal priorities for all humans, regardless of what job we have or anything like that. And the first one is self-care. You know, it seems like, you know, we have a duty not to harm ourselves. We have a duty to treat our mind, body, and spirit in a good manner, right? And that was the foundation of my research, is that I looked at, well, I found five people that were very, very good with their self-care, their physical care, diet, exercise, sleep, you know, all that, mental health, social, and spiritual. And what they did is they were very successful in their careers, and they also led a very balanced life. Meaning they had great relationships with their family members, and they took really good care of themselves. And as I recall, I think you mentioned the word self-care several times in your speech at the Health and Wellness Conference. You did mention about being a yoga instructor and meditation and things like that. It sounds like self-care, when you made the turn away from alcohol, became part of your new priorities, if you will. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's sort of an assumption I'm making. If you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. When I quit drinking, I was absolutely completely sedentary. I was overweight and out of shape and didn't care about a whole lot. And once I sobered up and I realized, you know, I wanted to try and get back into shape. That was my initial motivation, was probably vanity. But I didn't like the way I looked. I looked sick. I looked really bad. And I was finally cognizant that I could see it. So I started to run and do cardio stuff and trying to eat better, one ingredient foods, trying to avoid eating out of boxes and that type of thing. And just noticed that, boy, I really felt better. And at the time, my social worker encouraged, look into the recovery community. And I got involved in a 12-step program, which, as you go work the steps, I think self-care is a part of that as well. And doing examinations of conscience and, day in, day out, see what I can work on and where I may be deficient and where I'm doing well as part of that too. So those things helped out, getting back into shape, eating right. I started to, there are certain points that I think that I've really focused on, and they came up in the presentation that you were at. And there's like six areas that, as I looked at myself and thought, where can I improve my self-care? There are six areas that popped up. So like one is I started to, at the end of my shifts, as I'm driving home, I just kind of evaluated how I was feeling. Did I sleep at all on my shift? Did I feel angry when I got off a shift? If people have been telling me I'm angry, like paying attention to those little things.
Yeah.
Do I feel exhausted? Actually spending time with family. I was under the delusion that just because we were in the same structure together, we were in the same house, that I was spending time with them, right? How can they complain? I'm not going out to the bars. I'm spending time at home with them.
Yeah.
But I may as well have been a million miles away. I wasn't spending any time with them just because I was in the same structure, right? So
right.
That's something that I've prioritized, is it's not enough just to sit on a couch next to somebody. It's when they're talking to you, actually stopping and looking into their eyes and treating that conversation like it's the only conversation on earth. That's actually something I picked up from Mr. Rogers, that he always, you know, any conversation he had, he said that was the most important moment of his life, was that conversation.
That's good.
Yeah. And that's made a big difference, that, you know, you're prioritizing the people who you hope are going to be there for you when this job no longer is. And that's, I think, where firefighters sometimes get lost, is we become so career centric without any concept that, you know, one day this job's going to be gone and who's going to be waiting for us then. And now obviously is the time to develop those relationships and make them work. So that's been part of my self-care as well, as involving my family and, you know, being there for them and letting them be there for me. I can go on about, you know, I think another thing that, particularly in the career fire service, that firefighters are reluctant to do, but I sure wish we could find a way to get over the barrier, is if you have an employee assistance program, once a year, go to it. Your municipality has already paid for you to go. So at least once a year, make that appointment. You know, your hire date, that's what I do. June 4th, I make the call, whether I think I need it or not. I just go in and I talk to somebody at our EAP for an hour.
And you mentioned earlier that they are culturally competent.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is not what I'm hearing across the country necessarily.
I think that there certainly is an issue with that. You know, some EAPs are low cost bidders. Mm-hmm. So you get what you pay for. Another, you know, they're covering such a broad population of employees that, you know, you just can't have that cultural competence. Unfortunately, I think sometimes firefighters will use that as an excuse, because on some level, depression is depression, anxiety is anxiety, substance use disorder is substance use disorder. It doesn't matter what you do for a living, but there is a value in having cultural competence, as long as the firefighters aren't just using that as a crutch, that because they heard somebody else had a bad experience, they're not willing to reach out. You know,
yeah,
doing your own homework is useful.
That's true. And you mentioned about it doesn't matter, you know, like which industry and things like that. And I was going to make a joke, since you're an attorney, that was attorneys are in that top three, aren't they, of the most depressing careers?
Probably so. There's
you had two strikes.
If I would have just gone to dental school too, I probably would have had all three.
That's right.
Very true.
Well, Brandon, how about what are your priorities today when you reflect on it?
It truly is now my family is number one, and spending that quality time, and, you know, I'm actually at a point now where I'm looking forward to retiring, you know.
Yeah,
I could never have even imagined, but I'm looking forward to having that time. And I enjoy spending time with my family and being involved and going on weekend getaways. And like, we're going this weekend over to an area around Cincinnati to go forest bathing for a few hours. We have a guide that we're going to go do that. And forest bathing. It's a meditative practice, kind of a walking meditation, but it's done in a wood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you have a certified guide, and you stop at certain points and you listen, and other points you stop and smell, and another point you stop and touch what's around you. So kind of an immersive mindfulness practice, really, just done out in the woods. So that is really big on my priority list is my family. And my job still is too. And that can be tough. You know, since moving into the administration, it works a lot different than being out working on a fire apparatus. You know, before I worked 24 hours and I was home 48, and, you know, I worked my part-time job if it was available, but I had pretty clear boundaries. Mm-hmm. Once you move into an administrative spot, those boundaries get blurred a little bit. And that's been an adjustment where, you know, it 11 o'clock at night, if somebody needs access to peer support, there's only a couple of us who can take that call, you know? So, boundaries can be an issue, still. So it's, my family is a greater priority, overall, but there is that reality that this is what I do for a living right now. And 2 a.m, if somebody needs to get in to talk to a professional, you know, me or somebody else are going to be about the only two people who can get that done. So maintain, you know, and that's work-life balance, right? That's the whole thing is how do we have healthy boundaries, still get our jobs done, but not jeopardize our family. And it can be tough.
Yes, it certainly can. And it sort of goes back to something you were talking about earlier about how we, you know, identify as a firefighter or someone identifies as a law enforcement officer. Because my guest last week talked about he was a canine officer. It was his dream job. Mm-hmm. And his name was Scott. But he told me, he says it became an identity crisis because he wanted to be that canine officer for so long. And when he did, it superseded his wife, his newborn son. Everything was about the dog, the new job for years. And it was very, very stressful. And you know, it's part of that is that, you know, with that identity, and you mentioned about you looking forward to retiring, which you never thought you would, but it's creating those multiple and more complex identities that were just not a firefighter or law enforcement or an attorney or something like that. You know, we are a father, we're a husband, and
yeah,
you can, a friend, and you name it. And which as I think as we learn it, that's, it's good for our mental health when we can actually be more, we recognize we are much more complex than just single sourced as a certain type of an identity. Let me ask you, what are your toughest challenges today regarding your work-life balance and self-care?
It is kind of like I mentioned, establishing and understanding boundaries and having my spouse on board with that, hey, sometimes, you know, when we're on vacation, I have to have my phone with me. Because we're a large enough agency that nobody knows when I go on vacation. So if they reach out, they have to be able to get a hold of me. And then I can direct that call from there where I don't have to handle it, but I have to at least be that first link in the chain. So having that communication to say, you know, these are the boundaries and we agree on them, but this is how we deal with these situations. So that time management is a big part of it. What else? Can you repeat the question a little bit? I think sort I kind like of lost my train of thought.
Yeah, your toughest challenges when it comes to your work-life balance and juggling your priorities, I could say.
Yeah, and I did well, and part of that, you know, a complicating factor in the whole boundaries discussion is things like Zoom, where I used to be able to leave the office and maybe then after hours I would just get a phone call, or on the weekends I didn't have to worry about going into the office. Well, now the office goes home with me. And I think that's been a big change for not just for me, but I've heard other people discuss that I used to be able to leave when I left my computer. That was it. Nobody would bother me at home. But now, hey, let's, you know, after hours, 5 o'clock, let's do a quick Zoom meeting where we can all get in the same room. And then that's really kind of moved the boundaries back for a lot of people, which makes that balance a lot harder because it's hard to say no. And that's, you know, that's the affliction of public safety is we never, ever want to say no because we view ourselves as I'm here to help solve problems. I'm here to help out. And if I say no, what's my value? My value comes from my ability to say yes and help people solve problems.
Right.
That kind of turns in on itself, obviously, that if you never say no, that's your balance completely gets out of whack. So
yeah,
that's the challenge.
You know, it's few people realize that. And when we say it's hard to say no, actually what's going on is that when we say yes to the Zoom meeting, or to any other activity, we are saying no to something else in our life.
Ah, yeah.
We do it unconsciously, don't we?
Yeah.
It's we don't choice, even right? think about saying no to having the saying no to the family that's waiting to have dinner with us because we got that Zoom call scheduled.
Yeah.
And we do it unconsciously.
Yeah. That's, I hadn't even thought of that myself. That's absolutely true. I mean, it's still a choice just because we're not verbalizing the no, we're still choosing one thing over another.
Yeah. I did a little lesson on that once, and it sort of goes to that stimulus response, right? When we are asked if we can just try to pause to pull that unconscious out to the conscious level to say, okay, I want to say yes to this Zoom meeting, but what am I saying no to? Is it dinner? Is it my exercise? Is it, okay, I'm not going to be able to cook tonight. I'll have to stop and get a pizza. Mm-hmm. Whatever it might be, right? But if we can just pause so that we can consciously choose, and that goes back to my philosophy of choose your priority.
Yeah.
Choose your priority. If you've had dinner with family, using that analogy, example, you know, several times already or something like that in the week, and it's like no big deal, they're in a rush to get somewhere, hey, take the Zoom call. But if it's like, oh my gosh, I promised them I was going to be home, we were going to sit and talk. Hey, let me just see if I can push this Zoom meeting an hour, you know, one way or the other, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. But that's where I try to just, if we could just pause, because I know it, all of you guys and all first responders, it's yes, 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 all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think what's helped me too is to think, you know, if I don't do this, what's going to happen? And that's being able to use that pause as well, that like the world's not going to come crashing down. I can do it a few days later. You know, again, it's that prioritization that what's really going to happen if I can't do this. And last year I had some conferences scheduled and we had some family issues come up with some medical concerns that were quite stressful for my wife and I. And I finally just said, you know, I got to call these conferences and say, I'm sorry, but I can't do it right now. It's just not a good time. And I had to back out of a couple conferences, which was oddly liberating. Like I would have never considered doing that before really taking a look at my own life. Like I can't let those people down, but it came down to what you're discussing, that who am I going to let down if I do it? And where does that person fall on my priority list? And it's like, I'm going to let my wife and my son and my family down if I'm not there for them right now. And that's, you know, and again, you know, I called, I canceled on the conferences, which was tough, but the conferences went on. They had, you know, they did fine without me. Like, it's not like they were just, oh boy, Brandon Dryman can't be here. Like, you know, they did just fine. And I went with my priorities and it was the right thing to do, but you know, it took a lot of soul searching to get there, but it is all about that.
Well, that's good to hear. Hey, you know what, Brandon, one of the things I always like to ask is that my son, he is in Fire One school over here in Dayton at Sinclair Community College. He's taking that this semester and Fire Two next semester, as long as Corona doesn't cancel it out. But for young people entering the firefighting industry and perhaps ones that are already on the job, when it comes to this self-care and watching out for, well, how much are we drinking and things like that, what advice do you have for the younger up and coming firefighters, as well as I'm sure you give advice, you know, as you mentioned, your peer support and your trainings that you do, what's some of your best advice for the young people so that they maybe don't go through, they don't get too deep into it before, so that they don't have, you know, that rock bottom doesn't necessarily come to fruition.
The first thing is, you know, alcohol and substances are, particularly alcohol, is such a huge factor in what we do as part of our tradition. But I think most people recognize when they have a problem. They recognize when I'm no longer drinking because it feels good, and it turns into I'm drinking so I don't feel bad, which is a much different thing. And if you find yourself heading down that road, or if you find yourself that, you know, I do have a problem is one, not being afraid to reach out for help. And I know that can be a tall order because I've been there, but there are so many, you know, whether it's peer support, which is usually how it would come about, but you can reach out to confidentially and get help and ask questions. I would encourage people to do that. If you trust your EAP, great. As far as not getting down that road, you know, there are certain things that I do, like meditation, mindfulness practices, trying to get enough sleep, all that stuff that I think is what we're self-medicating, whether it's the anxiety or traumatic stress. We're usually medicating something that's underlying all that with substance use. Mm-hmm. So finding, you know, am I sleeping on my days off, or am I trying to get as many hours out of the day as I possibly can? That was a mistake that I made, is I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning on my days off, just to get, you know, so I would get as much out of the day as I possibly could, when I should have been going to bed at 9:30 or 10 o'clock and getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep on my days off, because we lose so much sleep when we're on duty. Being able to get that sleep whenever we're off duty is crucial. And that, yeah, I think can really help head off a lot of other issues. Our lack of sleep is driving a lot of our problems. Mm-hmm. And along with that, you know, we mentioned, I would tell people to eat right. It's firehouses. We eat on limited budgets. We make a lot of biscuits and gravy and a lot of unhealthy foods when we're on duty. Sometimes you're kind of stuck with that, but off duty, take control and have a good, colorful diet with a lot of single ingredient foods. Exercise, you know, we talk about that a lot in the fire service. We have different physical standards, but maintaining a physical activity on duty and off duty, whether you run or do martial arts, whatever it may be, but do something physically on your days off to mm-hmm. keep moving. Because again, that type of exercise helps head off a lot of behavioral health issues as well.
Yeah.
And then I meditate, I practice yoga, and these, you know, particularly when I came on the job almost 20 years ago, these were unspeakable items in the firehouse, right? Nobody would talk about meditation or yoga.
Right.
But it's starting to come around. And I think there's a generational issue, where younger generations are more open to these ideas, and look into it. I mean, those types of things can really make a difference. And it's something that you can even do with your family. You know, my wife and I meditate together. We do yoga together. Son will sometimes meditate with us. He's not as much into it, but you can, you know, draw out family time in that as well. Really valuable. You can heal together and grow together. And it's, you know, can be a very intimate process to sit in the same room and meditate with somebody, or to move your bodies in yoga asana practice. You can really connect with people that way. So it can be, in my view, a great thing to do with your partner or your spouse.
Oh, yes. Now I like all that. In the field of like what I teach, some of what I teach is I call a lot of that, it's called positive spillover, is what we do in one role in our life, how it affects other roles in our life. Right. So it's like the meditation, especially as you mentioned, doing it with your wife or son, you know, it also, you get, it's a bonding scenario mm-hmm. with you, but as you know, when you meditate, it reduces anxiety. It has a physiological effect on us as well. Our blood mm-hmm. pressure comes down. Yeah. So we have a lot of good things from that and a lot of positive spillover. Just as you mentioned, sleep, you know, that's how our bodies and brains, you know, they heal and repair themselves. And, but then of course we understand what negative spillover is also. You know, when we don't sleep, you know, does it surprise you that you're irritable?
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, wow, why am I so irritable? Well, I didn't sleep last night. Okay. And what's that going to, but just to be conscious of it, right? To start thinking about, okay, when I go home, I already know I'm irritable.
Yeah.
So I need to be really on guard, or, okay, how can I protect that? And like you were saying, like, let's schedule some sleep, you know,
yeah.
on your non-duty days. Yeah. So that spillover is so important. And the more we get our arms around it and understand ourselves is what I found in my teachings and coaching, is that when we understand how that spillover really affects us and our families and everyone that around us, we can manage it better by just being conscious of what we're doing.
Yeah.
I wanted to also, I know what I wanted to ask you about, sort of like your guiding principles in life. You know, sort of a general macro level question, guiding principles of life. What are they and sort of where'd they come from?
Wow. Well, I come from several members of the family were in the military, and they were also raised in a very religious setting. So there was a spirit of service in our family that I think is probably the biggest guiding principle of being useful or serving the people around you. That's probably the biggest overriding principle. And that's, you know, my brother and I are both firefighters. I think that we were both really guided by that. If I had to nail it down to one thing, it would probably just be that service element. I don't know, you know, there's a spirituality is also an important component of my life. And, you know, I think that certainly helps with resilience. It's something that I lost along the way for sure. But when I got my life back, that became another really important part of my life is a spiritual component. I mean, I think those are probably the two biggest things.
And can you go a little further on the spiritual from a bringing you back to sort of your religious practices when you, as you were growing up in that line?
Yeah, I made, I actually made a shift where I, you know, whenever I was drinking, I got away from everything. But when I got sober, I just kind of made the determination for myself that I just sat down and thought about, you know, what's out there, what do we know, what don't we know? And I just kept coming back to the idea that there has to be something bigger out there than I can understand. Like I intuitively, I don't know why, but that's my heart just tells me that something out there cosmically bigger than me. And I, you know, I think we're all connected. A lot of Buddhist teaching resonates with me. And I would maybe be more secular about Buddhism, but I still, to me, that's still spiritual. I would say that, you know, we're all connected. We all have this energy. The idea that the whole cosmos is in the universe is something that I would have thought was a little too crunchy granola not too long ago. But now I look at it and think, you know, it's, we really are all connected in that way. And what one person does can impact a whole lot of other people in good and bad ways. So really fostering that, our individual actions, my individual actions are important. They have repercussions, good and bad, that, you know, for a lot of people around me, whether I realize it or not, and really fostering that sense of connection is kind of how I look at it, at the spiritual side of things, and not doing harm and taking time to breathe and kind of keep myself centered so that I'm, and you mentioned this earlier, so that I'm responding rather than reacting. That little pause, I mean, there's an almost an infinite time within that pause that you can make really good or really poor decisions. And I was for a long time a reactor. Something would happen and I would snap. That was my judgment. And I wouldn't even think about it. I would just react.
Yeah.
But through things like mindfulness and a more spiritual life, I'm able to stop. And when those things happen, I don't have to have a snap judgment. I can take a second and respond to it. And that has made such a tremendous difference. And I think one of the things that first responders worry about with things like meditation and mindfulness is that I can't do that. I don't want to lose my edge. It's going to soften me up and I'm not going to be sharp. And, you know, I have found just the opposite. The ability to take that quick pause and to consider what I'm going to do and respond rather than react has made my decision-making a zillion times better. Like, sure. These things, meditation makes you sharper. You definitely don't lose your edge by becoming a more mindful person. You become a much better decision maker. And I think, you know, you don't really lose any real time. You just gather the ability to use that pause in such a way that you can make better decisions. And that's, you know, I think huge for firefighters and police officers and EMTs and any other frontline worker to recognize that a lot of the things we talk about with meditation just aren't true, where we, you know, well, I can't quiet my mind. I still, you know, I'm still thinking about stuff. And great, you know, that's a myth about meditation. You don't have to be able to empty your mind. You don't have to be able to sit still for an hour at a time. And it wasn't until I actually sat down and tried it that I recognized all that. And yeah. It didn't take long to really start seeing benefits. I started a mindfulness practice because I wanted to prove it wouldn't work. I found like a 28-day program and I was like, there's no way, because I had all the same misconceptions going into it, that I was going to lose my edge and it was going to make me, you know, soft. And, you know, I was going to want to walk around and pick flowers all the time and whatever else. And so I started doing it because I wanted to prove it wouldn't work. And I said, you know, I'm going to give it a fair shot. I'm going to follow all the rules that this program says to follow, just so there won't be any doubt that it won't work for me. And like within 3 weeks, I was like, wow, it absolutely works. And I've kept doing it ever since. And that's been 2 years. So it really does work.
For the listeners, if you would, Brandon, describe a little bit of, when you say mindfulness, what is it in general terms? What are you talking about here?
When we're being mindful, we are present in this very moment. And so we're not worried about what happened yesterday. We're not anxious about what might happen tomorrow. Those things are kind of illusory. The past is done. So worrying about that doesn't really solve any issues. We can learn from the past, but sitting and stewing over it doesn't help. And worrying about what may or may not happen doesn't help solve any problems either. So when we're being mindful, we are focusing on the very present moment without any type of judgment. So if you have feelings arise, you don't judge whether those feelings are good or bad. If you hear a sound, you don't judge what is that sound? What could that sound be? I hear sirens. Are they going to a fire? Could it be a bank robbery? Like you try and stop those thoughts to just say, I heard a siren. Mm-hmm. But you really focus on the present moment, because that's in mindfulness. The present moment is the only time you ever have. What's gone is gone. And we don't know what might or might not come. All we have is right now. And mindfulness gets you in the mode of just taking a few minutes and just focusing on right now. And there's several techniques for doing that. But that's really the goal of mindfulness, is to be present in the moment without judgment.
That's very good. And it sort of takes me back to the comment you talked about earlier, is that when you're having that conversation with your spouse or your child or anyone, is really focusing in on that conversation.
Yeah. And that is mindfulness. And we're so, I'm terrible about this, particularly as somebody who was a trial lawyer, is getting out of the habit as you're speaking, thinking about how I'm going to respond to that, you know, and yes. We all do it. We do it on EMS runs where I've heard this story from a patient 1,000 times and I know where this is going.
Yeah.
Getting out of that mindset and just truly being present, and I'm not judging it. I'm just listening to what you have to say. When you're done, then I can respond to that. But again, part of that comes down to the skills we learn from things like meditation is, I'm trying to judge what I'm going to say because I'm reacting to what I think you're going to say. If I can just stop, let you say that, then I can pause and respond. And again, we're talking about that reacting versus responding. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it all ties in together. And meditation practices. And I always say too, if you don't think you can sit and meditate for 5 minutes, there is such a thing as a walking meditation. You know, mindfulness walking. So if you are like, I just can't sit still, get on YouTube and look up, you know, mindfulness walk. And I guarantee you, you'll get plenty of hits, and just walk and meditate at the same time. There's really no excuses not to give it a shot. And it really does have those positive spillovers are tremendous. You can just see from sleep to conversations to not being nearly as angry and snap to judgment. All those positive spillovers start to happen. And really all you have to do is show up.
Yeah.
You don't have to be good at it. There's no being good at it. You just show up and try it and it starts to work.
Yes. Oh, that's great. Very, very good. And yeah, you're right. You can find so much out there on YouTube listen to podcasts or listen to all kinds of different things when you're taking a walk or just sitting quietly in a room.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I try to sit quietly, but you might be hearing over the microphone that my dog is snoring in the background. So sometimes Charlie is my other guest on the podcast.
I heard, I listened to you and Joe Lennon and like everybody had dogs going that episode. That was great. That's life though, right?
That's right. That is life. Well, let me ask you, Scott, is there anything that I did not ask you that you wished I wish I would have, or that you would like to spend more time on?
Nothing in particular, except to encourage people to try something new. I always close out any presentation that I do talking about self-care with talking about things like meditation and yoga or a martial art. I encourage people to try something like that out. The positive spillover, to use your term, is really there in those types of activities. That's kind of, I trained jiu-jitsu for a while, and that really kind of opened my eyes to there's a lot more to the martial arts than just fighting. Fighting is a very small part. You know, we would meditate at the end of a training session where we would just sit quietly on our knees and just be present. So trying to, I would just encourage people, look up meditation, learn about it, try it, look up yoga. Yoga is a world so vast that we don't have enough time on earth to talk about it all, but you can learn, you know, maybe give that a shot, or a martial art, something like that, but try something new. Put yourself out there, because the positive effects are tremendous.
Yes. And well, I'll tell you, I really appreciate you being on the show and sharing your story with the listeners. And to close this out, I mean, we have, of course, our special guest, Brandon Dryman, with Local 416 Firefighter, and talking about overcoming alcohol use disorder. You know what that brought, before I close completely, Brandon, can you help us understand what's the difference? You know how sometimes people say, or the term alcoholic, what is that just a term that's going away and now we're talking alcohol use disorder, or what's the distinction between the two?
Yeah, it is somewhat fallen out of favor, the term alcoholic or addict or user, that type of thing. There's obviously some negative connotations associated with that. It's, if you self-identify that way, it's okay, but it's identifying other people that way that is somewhat problematic from a stigma perspective. But what the addiction community has recognized is that most people don't go from not having an alcohol problem to the next day being an alcoholic. It's a chronic issue that gets worse and worse and worse over time. It's chronic and it's progressive. So people who work in the addiction field recognize that there's really a spectrum of use disorders, where you can have no use disorder, mild, moderate to severe. And they really don't look at, you know, you could be not have an alcohol dependence, but if you binge drink 5 times a year and you get in your car blackout drunk and drive home, you may not be technically what we would consider an alcoholic, but you do have an alcohol problem. You have disordered behavior because you're jeopardizing your own personal safety and other people's safety as a result of your drinking 2 or more times a year. And that's really what they look at. So the issue isn't so much dependence as it is potential negative consequences as a result of your use of a substance, if that makes sense.
Oh, yes, it does.
So yeah, it's more tied to the risks you're taking and the negative consequences of your actions as a result of consuming a substance.
Well, that's helpful, because I remember hearing that at the health and wellness conference, and I was meaning to ask you about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Well, thank you again, Brandon, for being my guest on the Get Balanced podcast and for opening up and sharing your personal stories with our listeners. And I want to let you know that I really do appreciate you and appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.